Okay, we spent some time last week, as I said, looking at the whole concept of wisdom literature and thinking it through, and talked about even the concept of wisdom, just to remind you a little bit about that. The word chokmah in Hebrew is the word for skill, and we talked about Bezalel. I couldn't remember the name last week, but Bezalel was the craftsman in Exodus 35 who was putting together the tabernacle, and they talked particularly about his chokmah, but they were talking about his skill, particularly in metallurgy and the use of silver and gold and all that he was crafting for the temple. But it was also applied to the people who made tapestries. And then later on, you see it applied to people who are sailors and their skill to sail. The people who are even professional mourners. We don't know sometimes what that is, but in the old days, they would actually have wailing women who, whenever someone died, you would hire them on behalf of another family to go stand at the doorway of the home and just wail and weep. It was perceived to be a way of helping people work through their grief. By hearing other people weep and cry, it made it easier for you to cry and not suppress your emotions. So they had these professional wailing women, and they're described as having skill and chokmah. But when we get into the book of Proverbs, or the book of Psalms, Ecclesiastes, that word, it winds up being applied in a different way. It's applied to the skill of life. So when you see the word wisdom in the Proverbs or in the Psalms, that's the word that's being used. It's a word that's a word for a craftsman, but as I said, it's really talking about the skill of knowing how to navigate a plan. It's the concept of being able to devise a plan and move the plan from A to Z. But when it comes to Proverbs, what we're really talking about is the skill of life. Being able to approach life with God's word and God's wisdom, to approach relationships with God's word and God's wisdom, to correctly navigate all of those things. That is what the wisdom literature is about, and particularly what Proverbs is about. It's about moral wisdom, relational wisdom, righteous wisdom. And then in contrast to that, of course, is the folly or the fool. That's all the way through the book of Proverbs. You have this opposition from these two camps. In fact, in Proverbs chapter 1, you get a good taste of some of this whenever he says in verse 20 of Proverbs 1, "Wisdom cries aloud in the street, in the market she raises her voice. At the head of the noisy streets she cries out, at the entrance of the city gates she speaks." So you have this, and you'll have it again in other places, predominantly in chapter 8, when wisdom is personified again as calling out from the beginning of creation. Wisdom is pictured as an eager participant or an eager advocate in your life. She is there. Crying out, calling out, begging people to listen to her. And so you get the impression that wisdom isn't reserved for just a few elite people. It's not reserved for people that have a particular IQ or intellect. Wisdom, at least the skill of navigating relationships wisely, work wisely, all of life wisely, that skill is available to anyone and everyone who will open up their heart and mind to it. You don't have to be a highly educated person. You don't have to be a particularly erudite person. All you have to have is an open heart to be able to listen to what she has to say. But then the writer contrasts this in verse 22. "How long, O simple ones, will you love being simple? How long will scoffers delight in scoffing and fools hate knowledge?" So on the other side of the paradigm is the fool, and the reason that they're foolish is because they love foolishness. And the reason that they are so having so many difficulties is because they are delighting in their scoffing. And so in this way, you might say it's a very individualistic kind of a book. It's a book that presents to you as the individual the choices that you're going to make, and then it confirms that you're going to make them, that you're the one who ultimately is going to be responsible for whether or not you are wise or whether or not you are foolish, and it's going to come down to your willingness to listen or to reject these two ways. So if you are a fool, it is your own fault. And if you are wise, it's because you've opened up your heart to that. That's the presentation of the book of Proverbs. By the way, both of these, wisdom and folly, are presented in feminine terms. So they're feminine in the Hebrew, and they're represented as feminine in the book. That doesn't have anything particularly to do with gender. It's just a convention of language. But wisdom is presented as a lady, and at times so is folly. So don't get on your high horses when you're reading verses about folly and start lecturing the ladies in your life about how folly is always pictured as a woman, because so is wisdom. So this is the book of Proverbs. It is designed in these sort of short, pithy statements that are supposed to be memorable or easily memorized, and they deal with all kinds of things, pride and humility, justice and vengeance, laziness and work, poverty and wealth, friends and neighbors, love and lust, anger and strife, masters and servants, life and death, all of the things basically that you deal with on a day in and day out or a week in and week out basis. And these are designed to be incredibly helpful for you to navigate all that. Now, in terms of the outline of the book, does anyone study the outline? Anyone want to tell us what the outline is? Charlie.
Yes, sir.
Charlie is getting ready for his ordination exam. So we, from here on out until he's ordained, Charlie is going to answer all of our questions as a trial. So. Yeah, this is not one of the central books, I understand, of your study, but.
So you have the Wisdoms of Solomon, like 1 through 29, and I think you have the Wisdom from Agur, which would be 30, and then you got the Wisdom of Lemuel, 31.
That's good. And what are
the God, the woman, is the 31.
Very good. What is any other key chapters that you know?
One seven or one eight? 1-7, and yeah. 1-8 through chapter 9 is Solomon to his sons, that wisdom.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then 31.
So. Very good. Yeah, that is a key break there in 1-7, where he's talking about the beginning of knowledge is the fear of the Lord. And of course, as you think about the book of Proverbs, you can think about it in these kind of chunks, 1 through 10. Roughly, 1 through 9, roughly, and then 10 through 30, roughly, and then chapter 31. 1 through 9 is the first third of the book, is these more long monologues that are given to his son. And they kind of take subjects and deal with them extensively with strings of thought. Once you get to chapter 10, then every proverb, they just bunch together, sometimes in no seemingly logical order, but just woven in and out, so you're dealing with multiple subjects per chapter. And, can make it sometimes, I guess, depending on how you look at it, can make it a little more challenging to study, or a little more interesting to study because of the variation that's there. But within that framework, there are a couple of chapters, at least, that stand out in my mind as I think about the book of Proverbs. There's obviously the two chapters that kind of exemplify the first third of the book. Chapter 3 is this long chapter, this appeal. It's the most direct appeal of the of Solomon to his son to listen to wisdom. This is where he's just pleading with him over and over again to listen to wisdom, to dress himself in it. And then, of course, Proverbs chapter 5 Proverbs chapter 5 and chapter 7. Does anyone know what those are about? The adulterous woman in two phases, really. Chapter 5 is sort of an introductory phase, and then chapter 7 really gets into the illustrations. It repeats some of the same warnings and then gives you this long illustration about a foolish young man. So, you know, those are the most extensive discussions of adultery that you're going to find anywhere in the scripture, and all of the pitfalls and dangers that's going to bring into your life. It has that very vivid image of adultery reducing you to nothing better than a loaf of bread. I mean, I always think about that and share that to just think, you know, how almost meaningless your life becomes, when you think about a loaf of bread, whether it is in terms of just being eaten, consumed by something, which could be the imagery there, or something that just quickly grows stale and is cast aside, which I think is also a very vivid picture there, because the passions of adultery are so often not built on the right things. They're not built on a love of righteousness and a love of honesty and a love of truth, because you throw all those things out the window to pursue adultery. And so you wind up building a relationship on something else, and whatever else you're building it on is fading. And so it gives you the picture of the kind of love that's quickly going to grow stale and is going to be cast out just like a loaf of bread. And so those very vivid images that are there are, and there are others that talk about that. So, you know, Proverbs 3, you know, if I had one chapter to go to in talking to my children, it would be, you know, Proverbs 3, you know, particularly talking to my sons, it would be chapters 5 and 7. And of course, chapter 8 is that very memorable chapter where the Lady Wisdom is pictured as being there together with God at the very beginning, at creation. It is, a lot of people have debated whether or not that Christ is pictured there in some way as the personification of wisdom. But I don't think that's the intent, nor is it necessary for the interpretation of the book. I think he's just picturing wisdom as coming from God. God is the source of wisdom, and wisdom has always been with God. So you have those. And then two other chapters, other than the final chapter, which is the virtuous woman that's normally, you know, recognized by everybody. Chapter 10 is the highest concentration of Proverbs on speech, on the tongue. You have them all over, but chapter 10 has more than anyone else. You know, that's the chapter that talks about how lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, or he says that, you know, in the multitude of words, sin is not lacking. So all those kind of memorable proverbs that have so much to do with the tongue are there in chapter 10. So certainly there are other things in chapter 10, because I said things are woven in there, but at least in my mind, chapter 10 is the chapter on speech. And then one final one that kind of is the central hinge of the book. It's like almost the very midpoint between the first 15 chapters and the last 16 chapters. In chapter 15, verse 32 and 33, wisdom ignores instruction. He who ignores instruction despises himself. He who listens to reproof gains intelligence. The fear of the Lord is instruction and wisdom, and humility comes before honor. It's almost like those two verses to me encapsulate the Proverbs, because it's basically an appeal to you to be open to rebuke. And not just open to rebuke for rebuke's sake, but open to rebuke because if you aren't open to rebuke, you can't grow. This is one of the things that, this is one of the paradoxes that people cannot seem to get through their head. They are often most resistant to rebuke because they think that it's going to show in them some sign of weakness or maybe some incompetency. But actually, it's the most competent people, the Proverbs is saying, who are learning from their mistakes. The most competent people are the people who are receiving rebukes. And so it's actually one of your signs of competency, one of your signs of wisdom, or you want to say it this way, one of your signs of greatness is actually your ability to be corrected and to welcome that kind of correction. You listen to reproof and gain what? Intelligence. You gain intelligence. And this is why humility comes before honor. This is why eventually those who are lifted up in honor are those that are marked by humility. Now, Proverbs, these pithy short sayings are axioms of life that are generally true. That is to say, they're not always true. That's not a knock against the infallibility of God's Word. That's a statement of the genre, the type of literature that we're talking about here. Because you can obviously find people who have walked with a lot of humility and yet aren't honored largely by the world, and you can find people who are exalted by the world who aren't very humble, but that's not the point of the proverb. It's not to deal with every exception, but it is to present the general course of life. In the general course of life, you're going to be honored by the kind of humility with which you walk, the willingness to rebuke. Now, this has never been more necessary in life than I think right now when people find avenues of exaltation, personal exaltation, that attempt to defy these kinds of principles, particularly in the influencer age that we're in. Everyone wants to be an influencer, and the fastest way not to be an influencer is to walk in humility. The fastest way to eradicate your influence is to actually admit that you're wrong on a regular basis. To do the very things that the Proverbs say. In fact, influencers typically make these assertions, and then when they're challenged, they double down. They triple down. I don't want to name any particular influencer, nor her claims against the French president's wife. But this is what you see people doing. They will make these ridiculous, outlandish kinds of claims. And then when it sort of blows up in their face, they just double down, triple down, and they can't be taught. They can't be corrected. But I think it holds true. Those people, they might have their season. They might have their few years of influence, but over the long course of life, you don't find them sustaining themselves in honor. They are flashes in the pan. What Proverbs is really wanting you to understand is the slow progression in the right direction of life. You're living a life of wisdom. You're living a life of teachability, you're living a life of humility, and over the course of life, that's going to result in where you want to be. As I said, there are exceptions, and obviously the most glaring one, at least in terms of a lifespan, would be Christ Himself. He Himself followed all the wisdom of Proverbs, and yet it didn't lead Him to riches and honor and ease in this life. But it did, obviously, in eternity. because God's going to give him a name that's above every name. So the Proverbs are speaking in terms of God's economy, in terms of God's estimation, and that estimation is not limited only to this life. It spans into eternity. So the Proverbs prove to be true eventually one way or another. So those are the key, at least the key markers I think of as I think through the book of Proverbs and the key chapters I think of. They're not all in your curriculum, I acknowledge that. But there are things that I think that you, could perhaps benefit from logging them in your mind. And if not those, find your own. I mean, study the book of Proverbs. I spent many, many years from my college years, probably, maybe until my early 40s, which was only a decade ago. But for most of those years, I spent reading a proverb every day, a chapter of Proverbs every day, memorizing different proverbs. So you're talking about, the span of 20 years, day after day after day, just reading the Proverbs and trying to think through what does it advocate me to do in my life? What kind of skill does it give me communication-wise, relationally? I felt like as a young man I needed that, partly because I was raised in a broken home, not a Christian home, did not have any kind of example of good communication or good relationships in my home. My mom left when we were really young. I was raised by my dad, and he was a mechanic, and every conversation wound up being about pistons. You know, no matter where you started, it always ended with a carburetor. And so communication was not a skill I had. So I just read the Proverbs over and over again, just learned about how to communicate, how to interact with people. And so I encourage you, do that. Know them like you would the back of your hand, and so that you can navigate not only through them, but navigate through life. Any comments or questions about the Proverbs? There's lots in there about economy. We could probably just have a great time taking all that stuff apart and thinking about what does it say about economics. It's shaped very much my view of economics, work, how you pursue riches, the kind of patience and diligence it takes for that. There's just so much that's in there that has formulated at least the way that I think about so many things. Yes, if you want to, he was asking about choosing your mentors. It more talks about your associations, not so much a specific person, but the kind of people that you're associating with. Walking with the wise so that you become wise. I know for me, it certainly shaped my perception early on of wanting to disassociate with foolish people. I just realized early on that, in my college years, while there were some fun personalities around me, that I didn't want to drift with their circle. So I made what felt like, at that point, a painful choice to distance myself from certain people and to put myself with others. I don't know that they were so much mentors back then, but they were putting me on a pathway of being around the right people, for sure. Any other comments or questions on Proverbs? Charlie needs a few more minutes to look at Ecclesiastes, so... Okay, Charlie. The book of Ecclesiastes... give us the outline of Ecclesiastes.
The thing is vanity, all is vanity. Living by this world is vanity. I'm not sure about the outline, but I know the conclusion is, the right conclusion is to not live by this world.
Yeah. Yeah. So your curriculum has a three-part outline. I learned this as a two-part way, 1 through 6 and 7 through 12. I think the curriculum you have has a prologue, like the statement that all is vanity, and then the proof in chapters 1 through 6 that all is vanity, and then the prescription of how to live in that kind of vain world. But I think the easiest, I mean, it's easy enough for me just to remember the two part, 1 through 6, 7 through 12. So it breaks down, you know, just in two equal halves there. And the early part of it is just that. It's just rehearsing over and over again this idea of vanity, which he says in the opening, verses, verse 2, vanity of vanity, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And he winds up in these chapters, 12 chapters, using this word 38 times. We're not going to rehearse all of them, but it is, incredibly repetitive in that. But it gives you the sense, as you read through it, of somebody who is lamenting. And that's the literary intent of that. Just saying it over and over and over again. Like the person who has made some tragic mistake in life, and they're just saying to themselves, why did I do that? Why did I do that? Why did I not listen? Why did I do that? They're not necessarily asking for an answer. They're not even thinking that there is an answer. They're just lamenting by this repetition. And so that's the picture that you get as you're going through this. This person has come to the realization, in some sense, that life is vanity, or the word is literally a word for empty. In his mind, life is just emptiness. And, if you live any length of time, you're going to struggle with this. If it's not in your early adult life, when people kind of start to realize what sometimes is called the rat race, or whatever you want to put on it, you just go to work and you get a paycheck and you come home and you pay all the bills and bank account's empty and you get up Monday and you do it all over again. And you're just wondering, why am I doing this? Why do I just continue to live this way? And you have fantasies that somewhere else in some other part of the world or some other time, it was different. But then you open up the book of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, you're like, no, this is the same thing that was going on thousands of years ago is going on today. And this is, of course, coming from the lips of a man who was incredibly wealthy. He was a king. He had everything that he could have hoped for at his fingertips, everything money could buy, and he was still coming to the same thing, same reason. So it gives you an insight beyond your own perspective. What you are experiencing is not unique to you, and it isn't solved over the horizon by either more income, more success, a different location, a different time frame. It isn't solved by any of those things. It's not solved externally. It's solved internally. That's where the writer winds up coming to the conclusion that all those things that he tried to fill his life with didn't fill his life. His life remained empty and remained vain. Or as he uses all these other terms, it was striving after the wind, or it was no advantage. Or in verse 11, kind of brings a lot of this stuff together. I considered all that my hands had done, the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity, a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So again, this guy had stuff. He had lots of stuff. And yet that stuff didn't satisfy. And you can talk to people even now, that have some measure of success or whatever, and you sit down and chat with them and start to talk to them, and you find that they're rehearsing the same thing. It didn't satisfy. It wasn't fulfilling in my life. I sometimes talk to people who go into retirement. They work their entire life with this fantasy. I'm gonna get a big nest egg, and then at some point I'm gonna unplug, and I'm gonna go into this life of ease. You know, it's gonna be so nice. Those, unfortunately, are some of the most depressed people that I end up talking to. They're depressed, I think, because they're feeling the emptiness of life when they don't have labor, they don't feel purpose or whatever. They got plenty of money to do whatever they want, but they're realizing the money doesn't satisfy. And whatever they thought the life was going to be, the life of ease and all that, doesn't satisfy. And so they struggle sometimes with that. And, you know, it doesn't even have to be retired people. Some people who achieve success earlier in life and they kind of start, you know, living the American dream, and you start talking to them, and that's right around the time that they're separating from their wife, having terrible relationships with the people around them. They're more miserable than they probably have ever been because they're trying to manage this money now, and it's got all kinds of problems, and they have what everyone wants, and that they still find it all to be empty. So the book of Ecclesiastes is written to give you a peek over the horizon and to let you know that that's not the answer. It's not the answer. It's still going to be vanity. It's still going to be emptiness whenever you do that. Everything under the sun that you might imagine is going to be the answer to your problem is not going to be it. And he does lament things like toil and labor and work a lot. He mentions those three concepts 34 times throughout these 12 chapters. It's not as if labor and toil itself are bad, but they're not the answer in and of themselves. He's not lamenting necessarily the sweat of labor or the long hours of labor. He's lamenting the fact that the labor itself, when it's all said and done, what you accomplished isn't enough. And so you still feel the emptiness, and it helps you to realize that, you know, whatever you're building, if it's literally a building, or if it's a corporation, a department, a contract, or whatever it might be, whatever you're building is never going to be enough. I mean, you think, you know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to work hard, I'm going to look back, I'm going to have pride on my work. And there's always a measure of that, but it's just never going to be enough. You're going to walk away and it's all going to be chasing after the wind, as he says. You could build the most magnificent company and it's going to have its shelf life. I'm not sure. Do we have any companies that have been around more than 100 years? Is there any company? Ford probably is approaching that. Ford Motor Company.
Maxwell House Coffee.
Well, that one's that. Well, I'm talking. That one should have died. Okay. It will soon die. I'm gonna go and make a declaration. Are there any others that? Okay, well, Delta, yeah, they might be around a little bit longer. But no, not many companies that are built outlast, you know, their founders, really. Or they might last just a little bit longer, these big, you know, corporations. But they all have a shelf life. And so, you know, you just kind of imagine that what you're doing is this monumental thing, but it's going to be like the wind. You know, it's going to blow away. And so the writer is trying to help you get that perspective as you're going through this. And so along the way, as he gets out of the sort of description of the vanity of life and he starts to get into the prescription of how you live with that, he begins to just talk about some of the beauties of what the Lord has made and the recognition of how we need to appreciate both wisdom and love, where he gets into in chapter 9, Go eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments always be white, let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he's given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, for there's no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you're going. So he tries to start sort of redeeming this and starting to say, God has given you things, so figure out how to enjoy those things. But really, it all comes down to the very end, where literally he says in verse 13 of chapter 12, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. So he lets his mind go over the whole of life, all of the world, and he comes down to that one conclusion, that in the pathway of God's commandments is wisdom and fulfillment. So that's the book of Ecclesiastes. And then really quickly, the book of Song of Solomon. Our last book for the wisdom literature is this celebration of marriage. And Charlie, what's your take on Song of Solomon?
God's view of love and marriage, and it's basically broken into leave and cleave and then weave. So chapters 1 through 3 is leave, and I think 4 through 6 is probably cleave, and then 7 and 8 is weave.
Okay, so good. The best part of that is we recognize this is about love and marriage, because so many people have come to this and try to read it allegorically. People still do this, read it allegorically. There are songs that are written from the book of Proverbs that are all about God's love for you or your love for God. I remember in my charismatic days, some of you guys don't know that I had charismatic days. I became a believer in the charismatic church. But we always sang that song, you know, his banner over me is love. You know that song? Well, that comes out of Song of Solomon. This adopting of terminology from the Song of Solomon to describe God's love for us. And it flavored my reading of the book of Song of Solomon for a number of years. I would go and read it and try to read it sentimentally, in the sentimental way of how God loves me. That makes sense in the pop culture when most Christian songs are written that way. You know, all of our Christian songs are about how God takes us in his loving arms and squeezes us and, you know, whatever it might be. That seems to dominate the modern, what would you call that? Lyrical bent of songs. But that's not the purpose of the Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon is not about God's love for you or about your love for God. It is about the love of a man and a woman, the joys of marriage. And in a very beautiful way, it is weaving together pictures of that union. And as Charlie outlined for us, it moves kind of sequentially or chronologically through the course of what we might call courtship, and then betrothal, and then ultimately marriage. As he put it, leaving and cleaving and weaving your lives together. And although it focuses on those early stages of marriage, it really gives you a pattern for lifelong interaction between husband and wife. It teaches you the skill, again using that word chokmah, it teaches you the skill of marriage, and it does it more than any other book of the Bible. We, of course, always think about Genesis 2 or Ephesians 5. Those are the passages that we often so often quote in marriage sermons or in weddings. But the most extensive and detailed handbook on marital love is the Song of Solomon. And what it's really teaching you are three basic things. that first of all, intimacy in relationship is to be expressed verbally. It's obviously a book, so it has lots of words, but it is giving you the record or the prescription of the way that a wife talks to her husband and the way that a husband talks to his wife. And it's not just factual assertions. It's actually creative verbal expressions of love for one another. And it tells you that you need to do this in marriage. You need to push yourself and strive within yourself to be verbally expressive of your love towards your spouse. That's not easy. I mean, I set out, years ago I was giving my wife 100 reasons why I loved her, and I would write one on the chalkboard and on the counter every day. And, the first 25 were easy. And then I found myself, in the next 25, really, really stretching myself. But I thought that's a good thing. I need to do that. I need to be stretched to find ways to verbally express my love for my wife. And if you're wondering, I haven't completed my assignment yet. I'm still working on this. But my wife knows that, I'm still laboring in this. We had to get rid of the chalkboard. I'm going somewhere with this.
Use the bathroom.
We had magic marker. Okay, well, the mirror would have worked, yes. That's in the first day after my honeymoon, I got up to go to work and found a lipstick note on the mirror from my wife. So that's a very good word right there. But I was rummaging through the drawer for something, after we got rid of this, and I found a little notebook where she had taken what I wrote in chalk and wrote every one of them down in the notebook. She didn't tell me that, but I was recognizing that what I was doing was very meaningful to her. So we have to do this. Not just in your newlywed or courtship days, but throughout your life, be stretching yourself to be verbally expressive in your love towards your wife. The second thing that Song of Solomon teaches you is that time is irreplaceable. That he celebrates, or she celebrates, the time that they spend together. They long for those seasons, or sometimes it's expressed in the Song of Solomon more in terms of the aching of not being together and the eagerness to be together, and there's just nothing that's going to replace that. So the Song of Solomon is teaching you that you must give time. You must give time. And it's not going to be, it's not going to fit within the definition of productivity that you have been conditioned to think about as a typical American male. You've been taught to think about, getting certain things, tasks done, and so you do that at work. You have your to-do list, or you've got your task list, or you've got your assignments that you got to turn them in, by whatever deadline, your reports and all of that. Do all your visits, all your phone calls. And then you get home, and then you've got another list. Whether it's given to you or not, you've got another list. And so you get home, and it's all the stuff you got to do outside, all the chores that you have to do, and the parts of the house that are falling apart, and then you might mix in a couple little league games and all that, and you're just checking off the list, and you don't really stop to realize the necessity of just time, of just sitting on the back porch, listening to the breeze, hanging out with your spouse, and sharing your life together and your heart together. But that's what the Song of Solomon is articulating. He's just telling you the principles, the basic principles of what love looks like. And then he really does a great job of showing us that love is admiration. It's finding unique delight in your spouse. The writer is comparing his wife or his betrothed or his whatever to all kinds of things and showing how none of them match up to her. He does it over and over and over and over again. It's just like a whole book of comparisons. And some of them are comparisons to nature. Some of them are comparisons to life goals. Some of them are comparisons to experiences. And he just keeps saying that none of them measure up to you. None of them measure up to you. The highest, greatest satisfaction in life that I'm going to find in this earthly life is going to be in you. And so it's another great insight into marital love, the way that you express that to your spouse. And as I said, this is focused more on the front end of the equation, more in the courtship and betrothal and marriage, but it is a manual for marital love for all of life. This is not something that is to last only the first 5 years of your marriage. It's something that is to go with you to the very, very end. And in fact, it ought to be something you're getting better at. It's not something you come out of the gate strong and then kind of fade. It ought to be something that with more years, you're improving your skill like you would any other skill. If this is the chokmah, the skill of life and the skill of marriage, then let it be like a skill that develops and gets more efficient and more productive with time. So that's the Song of Solomon. Any questions or comments about that? Yes, Isaac. It's a good question about, you know, the advice to get married young. I guess my question is, what is young? That line has moved a lot through the ages. We live in an age that has created a phase of life that has never existed in the history of mankind that we call adolescence. But prior to the advent of the 20th century, I mean, that concept was hardly a concept. When you reached what we consider to be adolescence, 14, 15, 16 years old, many people were already moving out into the workforce. Education, the advent of free education or government education profoundly changed that in our minds, where we have compulsory education that is still not compulsory in most places of the world. And throughout the history of mankind has not been a thing. And so because we have compulsory education that keeps people in school till they're 18, the assumption, therefore, is that, you know, in school you don't have time for a family and you don't have the ability to make an income. That is largely true. But I think it has created issues. It's created issues of sexual tension and temptation that now our generation faces in ways that previous generations maybe didn't face. Not saying that sexual temptation has never been a problem, but it has accentuated it, I think, because we have prolonged singleness. And so, you know, by the time you get to 18, you know, in most times in societies, people were getting married. They were getting married. Those were the child productive years. And I think if you look across the course of history and the course of the world, that is the natural time to get married, you know, 18 to 20 to 22. But what do? We prioritize more education. And so we wind up telling people, well, you need to get now you need to get finished with college. And then, of course, when you look at statistics, while we have done some things to make college more accessible, the truth is people are moving through college more slowly than they ever have. The average length of time for people to finish a bachelor's degree actually is longer today, even though we have classes in high school, dual enrollment and all that other stuff. Kids are just taking, maybe they can't handle the stress, you know, whatever it might be, but they're just taking longer to get through college. And so that just elongates the picture. And then you mix in all the sort of progressive mentality of expressive individualism and, you know, going out and living your life and all that. Now people want to get their car and they want to get their house and they want to get all that other stuff before they get married. Why? I mean, tell me why. Well, the general answer is because if you get married before any of that, then you're going to have a hard time getting your stuff. And I just don't think that those are the priorities that you find in Scripture. I think the priorities have more to do with character and purity and integrity. So in general, I think it is an overall good message. But then to balance that, like you said, we have to tell people to choose wisely who they're going to marry. And that wisdom must come through consultation with those people who are trusted in your life. They're going to be the ones who are going to help you navigate the passions of folly in the early days when you are driven, you know, maybe too much by your hormones and not enough by your wisdom. You need good counselors around you. You need obviously loving parents around you. You need good mentors around you who are going to help you choose wisely. So you have to approach it, I think, with the tension of those two things. Marriage is a wonderful thing. In the course of our life and the way God's made us, we should strive for marriage early, but we should strive for marriage wisely as well. And I've known people who were married and in college, and they did fine. I know for me, I'm just talking about from my own personal experience, I was unmarried in college. I was married in my master's degree. And I was a way better student in master's degree. Marriage actually made school easier for me. You know, it was hard in the financial sense, but in terms of being a student, it was easier. You know, we have to just make sure that we have the right priorities. I'm over time, so I wish we had more time to discuss that. Maybe we can circle back to it someday. But thank you, guys. We're done, and we will see you, Lord willing, Sunday.